Rob Wolf, Andy D's back with episode 51, Paleo Solution. What is shaking?
Dude, I'm still running on European time. Like, I'm going to bed at like 6:30 or 7 in the evening and waking up at like 3:30 in the morning. I'm keeping Butte County methamphetamine addict hours.
God, so many things wrong with that statement. How was the trip?
It was awesome. It was awesome. Denmark was totally amazing. I was massively jet lagged when we first got there, but it was super, super cool. Got to hang out with Nicole and Franklin, who used to own part owners in CrossFit Oakland. Super cool people. Franklin's also a chemist, so he and I get to bro out on chemistry-related stuff. And then we went to Italy and went from Milan to Florence. And while taking a train ride from Milan to Florence, I was sitting next to a nun who was coughing on me incessantly, and I swear she had Ebola, and so I kind of got a little bit sick from that. But Florence was totally amazing. We had really good food. Like, I have some really kick-ass road foragers from just eating through Italy and whatnot, so that'll be super cool to put up.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. And you're heading out this weekend, right? So this episode will be posted the day you get back, I guess, right?
Yeah. So we're going to Anaheim doing a gig for Naval Special Warfare this weekend, and then we are doing the NASA gig a couple of days after. When this podcast posts, it'll be a couple of days after that. So yeah, hopping, man. I'm glad to be home with the gato, though. He's been very needy. So
no, he missed you, obviously.
Yeah. We have a pretty good rotation of people coming in taking care of him while we're gone, but it's never quite the same. So.
So, Rob, while you were gone, we had a gentleman, Mark, and his wife, Aubrey, come up from Sacramento. Big fans of the podcast, do a little consult, work on his some of his starting strength type stuff. And he walks in the gym, and he's like, the first thing he says to me is, he's like, huh, I was expecting a much bigger beard.
I heard about that.
and so I was like, well, Rob Wolf, I mean, what were you expecting? ZZ Top? I don't know, man.
Which I thought was super cool, finding the ZZ Top concert poster in Denmark. That was pretty sweet. So,
yeah. So, you know, people are out there listening, Rob. And just for clarity, my beard is not as long as ZZ Top.
It is not. It's still impressive, though. It's damn impressive.
Well, so. I got to shave it this weekend because I'm going to see Dallas and Melissa. You know, Dallas will have like a perfectly coiffed beard, so I'm going to have to clean myself up a little bit so I don't look like a Wookiee.
A schlep.
Yeah.
It, being around Dallas always makes one feel schleppy. he just cleans up well. So, cool.
Yes. Cool. So, we got a cool group of questions. The first one, Rob, is from our friend Nathan, who posted a hilarious picture comparing myself to Chris Pontius from Jackass on his Facebook page. So,
that was hilarious. That was super cool. Yeah.
So, just for posting that, he gets first question of the episode.
Perfect.
So, here we go. Hey, Rob and Andy, wanted to ask a question for the Paleo Solution about leaning out. Currently returning from my 2-week honeymoon in New Orleans and Little Corn Islands and a 2-week business trip to Oahu. I'm going to insert an editor's note. I really bleed for you, buddy. That sounds like a rough month.
Seriously.
So anyway, my diet went to hell in a handbasket, and I might be a borderline alcoholic from the copious amounts of booze I drank in all 3 locations. Needless to say, my sleeping habits have been trashed as well. I consider myself an insomniac, where sometimes I force myself upstairs only to lay awake with my thoughts bouncing around my skull and eventually falling asleep a few hours later. All right, here's the meat and sweet potatoes, 28, 6'2", 210. Not sure what my body fat is, but it's not Brad Pitt-esque for sure. I get between 4 to 8 hours a night, depending on my undiagnosed insomnia. My goal is this: sweet freaking abs. Vain, I know, but I could give 2 shits about elite level performance, especially ever winning or striving to be in the CrossFit Games. I just want to look badass. I think most people are lying if they say they don't care about looking rad naked. I'm not fat by any means, but no one is confusing my midsection for Mr. Brad Pitt's. Here's what I think you'll recommend. Get at least 8 hours of sleep, paleo eating a la 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight with minimal or no fruit, no alcohol, oh God, please don't take away my tequila, natural comp to get me sleepy, vitamin D, and fish oil supplements. Am I right so far?
Yeah.
Let's start there. Good?
It is super good, and I just have to back up a little bit. The Little Corn Island is a really just like as off the beaten path as you could get, but the booze there is like a really amazingly good, like a Fleur de Cana 750 milliliter bottle of rum is like $3. So it is really easy to become an alcoholic there. back to our regularly scheduled program. I mean, this all seems totally spot on. You know, attack sleep, paleo, keep carbs on the low side for the most part. Maybe, you know, post-workout carb spike here and there. Vitamin D, fish oil, good to go.
And so here's the money question, Rob. Training, ? Wendler 531 program with sprints and Tabata work, pure CrossFit main site, CrossFit football. The Marine in me tells me more cardio is better, but my inner Rob Wolf says, holy cats, limit that fracking shite. What training, assuming all my nutritional and sleeping habit ducks are in a row, will get me to Abbeville?
We totally need to do a trip and go with Nathan somewhere. I don't know where, but somewhere.
Then he goes on to say, thank you for your time and consideration. By the way, Rob, thanks for the little Corn Island recommendation. The wife and I love Nicaragua. Also, Andy, your Facebook profile picture kind of reminds me of Chris Pontius, a.k.a. Party Boy from Jackass. You should be stunt doubles. Thanks again, and I look forward to your thoughts. I actually need to take his picture that he made and make that my new profile picture because it's freaking hysterical. Awesome. So anyway, Rob Wolf, we'll throw it out to you first. Training for Nathan's goals of Brad Pitt-like abs.
Yeah, you know, I just had a consult with a girl yesterday, actually a type 1 diabetic, and trying to get a handle on her blood sugar levels and on her body fat levels and all that. She's a real athletic, a good athlete, but it's just interesting. To get really, really lean, like the work output actually needs to be in this more moderate area, like much more along the line of like classic like bodybuilding or strength work mixed with a little bit of sprint work. You could certainly do some interval training, but you know, Clarence Bass had a great piece on some intervals where he was talking about the need to periodize this stuff and you know, say like if you were going to do some rower intervals, your first week on the rower you might do 3 to 5 500-meter rows, but with a, say, like a 2-minute 500-meter row split. So, you know, not really that hard. And then the next week, maybe shooting for like a 150 split. The next week, you know, maybe like a 140 split, and like you're keeping your rest intervals the same. So like ramping that intensity up over time and then providing some unloading and then some changing and all that sort of stuff. If you subject your body to a really massive amount of stress, you will not be able to run super, super lean. Like it just doesn't happen. You can run really lean with kind of a sprint bodybuilding, sprint powerlifting, you know, kind of combo, because the loading that you're getting is of a short enough intensity that we're not really digging into that glycolytic pathway so hard that is causing a blood sugar crash that then is being answered with a cortisol release. And then since Nathan's already kind of showing some like hypercorticism type stuff, you know, like the head that's just kind of spinning and going and going and going, probably better to do some mellower type training. But you absolutely can get like freakishly lean on this. And this is kind of the Art Devaney-esque, you know, sprint protocol type stuff that I was doing prior to CrossFit. And you know, we've talked about this a bunch. Like CrossFit filled a lot of holes in my game, and it introduced me to a type of intensity and type of training that I had never quite done before. But I also found that to be competitive in that realm at all, I was always operating at a higher body fat level than really what I kind of wanted to do for just, you know, vanity reasons, and also for some performance reasons that were kind of related to strength to body weight ratio stuff. So I think that this is all spot on. Like Nathan's totally spot on. It's just we may need to do some sort of an intervention to get him off of the booze. So
Nathan, I feel like a month of boozing, you know, deserves you know, 12 months of less boozing, maybe, you know,
maybe. Yeah
unless you are naturally look like Iggy Pop,
in which case maybe we need some Krispy Kremes on the back end of that. So yeah,
cool. Good question. And by the way, I just noticed Nathan put a note and asked me if I wanted to take down the Chris Pontius, a.k.a. Party Boy picture, and I told him, heck no, that's my profile pic, buddy.
Awesome.
All right, moving on. Next, we got a question from CrossFit Northwest. Longtime listener, first-time questioner. I'm fully paleo, but only supplement with BCAAs now. Would you recommend taking a pre-workout supplement like nitric oxide or the like? I'm not a coffee drinker, but even that could give me a kick. Thoughts? I am 100% paleo apart from the BCAAs.
You can play with it, but you know, all of those nitric oxide releasers, I've tinkered with them, never really saw any type of like benefit out of it. The studies on it are really dubious. If you wanted to get probably the best bang out of anything like that, like doing 2 to 4 grams of just arginine pre-workout, like that's the arginine is really the nitric oxide precursor, like kind of the biggest factor there. Arginine can also enhance some growth hormone release. Like there's some cool stuff that can be had from some smart amino acid supplementation, but you can get completely like geeked out on this stuff. Like, you know, are you eating really clean paleo? Are you sleeping 9 to 10 hours a night? Are you supplementing with magnesium? You know, do you have a smartly periodized program? Like all of that stuff is going to give you better return on your investment before tinkering with some of these really fine point type things. And then from there, there's some stuff that, you know, definitely works. Creatine definitely, you know, seems to, for the people who are responders, it really improves that short-term power output and seems to help recovery a little bit and has some nice blood lipid effects. I think beta-alanine is some pretty good stuff and has some benefit, definitely way more pricey than creatine. But I would really focus on like good nutrition, good sleep, smart periodization. If you're not following some periodization, get a coach who can periodize for you. Dan John has a nice saying that he who coaches himself has an idiot for a coach, and I've been an idiot for an awfully long time, and I'm finally coming around. I think when I finally am through with this big travel block, I'm going to have Keith Norris from a Theory to Practice set me up with a program to get me in jiu-jitsu shape and try to meet some other performance goals. But just giving up that responsibility of doing my own training development. And so that's all the stuff I would focus on before looking at all the nitric oxide releasers and stuff like that.
But you can get some cool vein action.
Maybe.
Dude, all the high school kids take that stuff, man. I'm sure it works.
I'm sure it's working for them. Yeah, totally.
Cool, good question.
Yeah, totally good question. I like how Andy has snuck in like 15 supplement questions into this thing too. So.
Well, Rob, just going to leave it alone.
Yeah. As Andy pointed out, the supplement podcast was probably not going to happen before like 2012. So, yeah, it's probably.
Next, we got a question from Jim. Hey, Andy, got a question for you guys. My wife is back to work after a year off raising our first child. Our son has been breastfed, and eats a 90% paleo diet. We'd immediately give in on occasion with crackers and bread when he simply won't eat anything else. We've looked into daycares, but the affordable, even expensive ones, have terrible food choices, mostly based on DCFS requirements here in Illinois. One brilliant menu example we were given was a veggie burger with tater tots and french fries. I shit you not. The kitchen we toured at another daycare was a hodgepodge of frozen chicken fingers and canned veggies and fruit. Any suggestions on how to navigate this stuff without spending thousands on special daycare venues or expensive in-house nannies? All we want is what's best for our son, but today's institutions simply haven't caught up. Thanks, Jim.
Oh, boy. You know, I thought about this one a ton, and maybe this would be a good one for listeners to chime in on. The really tough thing is that the in my experience, and we don't have kids yet, but you know, we've seen a lot of people kind of go through this stuff. The better daycares, like you get into like a Montessori deal or something like that, you know, and that's getting beyond that, but beyond daycare, but the better daycares seem to, you know, if they have some good curriculum and they're teaching some kids some science and some art and some music, they're all completely like vegetarian in orientation. So like all the snacks are like brown rice and like tofu wedges and stuff like that, which at the end of the day, I would way prefer that versus like goldfish crackers and, you know, whatever else, you know, you're feeding the kids. I think grains in general are a problem, but obviously I think like some brown rice is probably less problematic than some sort of like wheat containing item. It's really a tough deal because any forward-thinking institution, like inevitably, it's a vegetarian in orientation. Like everybody's a hippie, everybody's vegetarian in orientation. You might be able to get into a situation in which you're basically like our kid is more or less grain intolerant, and then you're able to pack a lunch for them. But I think that many of these daycares have problems with that now because kids have so many food allergies, and so you can't actually bring food from the outside because it's potential like peanut or, you know, tree nut contamination and all that stuff. I don't really know what the good solution is with that. I mean, it may just boil down to you get a good breakfast, you get a good dinner in the kids, you can, you know, you've got more control over the weekends, and then you just you do the best you can within the parameters that they have. Try to see if they've got any type of like special nutrition requirements. For sure, getting a gluten-free menu for the kid would be, I think, a big move in the right direction at the very least. But I don't know, that's a really tough one to navigate. And again, maybe some listeners who have some kids and have navigated this thing personally would have some better insight on that.
I got nothing to add, Rob.
Nothing. Okay. That's a biggie, man. It's a biggie. And I think over the course of time, we're going to see things improve on this, particularly, you know, like at a base level, like the gluten-free awareness is getting much, much better. But it's so funny even within that, like I was talking to a dietitian who herself had celiac, and, you know, she was really like, you know, gluten avenger, you know, like people shouldn't eat gluten, but she was totally, you know, advocating all these like gluten-free pancake products and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, you know, those things are problematic too from an autoimmune consideration. She's like, oh no, they're not, you know. And like we had this debate back and forth, and I finally shot her this paper showing consumption, basically almost identical celiac type symptoms in kids. Basically they were calling it rice intolerant, and it was manifesting exactly the same way these kids got it from eating brown rice and all this stuff. And she was just shocked. She's like, I just can't believe that rice would cause this problem. And it's like, dude, the one grain caused the problem. Why would it be so earth-shattering that the other grain's a problem? But I still think in the grand scheme of things, the gluten's probably the big, big issue to take care of. So,
but now they got this cool sections in the supermarket, Rob, where it's all gluten-free with the gluten-free brownies, which I'm sure are healthy. You should be able to eat brownies at every meal.
It is true. I advocate it. We will have a line of those on the website tomorrow.
If only that were true.
And you can have five fries with those.
Five fries. Oh, my Lord. All right, moving on.
Moving on.
Question from Melanie. Far be it for me to question you, Rob Wolf. I'm all in on everything you advocate. However, could you please take one more look at coconut sap, in particular Coconut Secret Raw Coconut Nectar? The label says it's only 0.5% glucose, 1.5% fructose, 16% sucrose, and 82% inulin. I know in the past podcast you said you thought it was primarily fructose. The link to the stuff is here. Thank you for your enlightenment on all things paleo. I'm recovering and getting well.
Yeah, this link, like with the product that she has linked here, that Melanie has linked here, it does look like it's mainly an inulin product. Inulin is a long-chain polysaccharide. It's fairly sweet, and actually it has some kind of cool effects by helping to boost beneficial flora in the gut and everything. I would still, this thing is still though a refined carbohydrate product. I mean, it would be similar to maltodextrin or something like that. So I mean, I would still use this sparingly. The coconut sap that I looked at previously was basically a fructose sucrose blend, and so it was probably about like 70% fructose or something like that. So it definitely wasn't all that great of an option. You know, it wasn't something magical. This looks different. I don't know if it's a different process, if it's a different type of coconut plant. Like I don't know what the deal is on that, but this looks pretty legit as far as it goes. But it is still definitely a refined carbohydrate source. So I mean, you can't just like go wild and spritz yourself with this stuff. So yeah, or you could. Maybe that would be fun. I don't know.
Well, you can. You just might not get the results you're looking for.
Yeah. It's not going to be super healthy. You know, and we just keep revisiting the alternative sweetener deal. It's like sucanat sugar and then brown rice syrup and then what's the tequila stuff?
Agave.
Agave nectar. And, you know, it's just thing after thing. And so now, you know, coconut is kind of a... favored sun right now because, you know, we're digging on the coconut products. The MCTs are good for you. Saturated fat appears to finally be getting exonerated from any type of implication in cardiovascular disease and stuff like that. And so everybody's looking at coconut products in general, and the coconut sap deal seems to be gaining some foothold as a sweetener, but it's still a sweetener. And so you've got to use it with some rational thought. And if you've got, you know, body composition goals, weight loss goals, or anything like that, like it's still not all that great of an option.
Sorry to let that secret out, Rob.
Indeed. Indeed.
All right, Rob, next we got a question from a contender for the best handle.
It's a goodie.
This is a question from the edible Just Incredible.
I like it.
He says, much like the other 12 listeners, I like booze. So I was hoping you could give your thoughts on drinking and how to best get silly. I'm not going to pretend that the antioxidants in wine make fermented grape juice the ideal paleo beverage of choice, as much as I'd like it to be. Sadly, I know better. So what are your thoughts on wine, tequila, clear liquors, rum, and whiskey? I can thrive on meats and veggies all day and live all day, all the live long day, but a caveman in training needs to get his drink on every now and again. So how to best get silly while minimizing gut health damage? This is being asked by someone that eats damn near nothing other than locally grown veggies, grass-fed meat, and wild-caught fish cooked in delicious fats, for what it's worth.
I thought we've covered this.
Just like the next question, we have covered many of these. This is like the, you know, I think sometimes people want to ask the same question again, hoping that they get a little different answer. So, and as the most popular recipe you've ever given was the NorCal margarita, you know, every alcohol question is a good question.
Right. It's true. Let's revisit this, folks, shall we? So. Yeah, I mean, the NorCal margarita seems like a thing of perfection to me. The tequila, some lime juice of one lime, so actually a lot of lime juice. Like, I would run equal amounts booze. So like any way you want to mix this stuff, whether it's gin or vodka or tequila, do an equal amount of, like, lemon or lime juice. It just really enhances the flavor a lot. Then a splash of soda water, and I think you're just rolling. And that, to me, seems like the best way to get your booze on. We are really minimizing glycemic load. We're not really taking in hardly any type of carbohydrates. The bubbly, fizzy water helps to enhance the absorption of the booze. You take down a couple of double NorCal margaritas on an empty stomach, and you will absolutely get a great head change. And then you eat your protein and fat later in the night. Just try not to drink too close to bedtime so it doesn't blunt growth hormone release. And then we have our old standard of, the best way to gauge your drinking is drink as much as you can such that it optimizes your sex life but doesn't impact your performance or recovery. And I think that's, like, as good a standard as you could do. We have been tinkering with a drink option, which is low carb, but it's damn yummy, and it's basically doing kind of a coconut milk, or not coconut milk, but coconut water plus, although we did, when Wellborn and I went to Nicaragua, we did a bunch of coconut milk pina coladas, and we got fat, man, shocker, but I'll talk about that one here in a second, but coconut water plus rum, and then you can do just a little bit of mint, and like doing a mojito out of that, and it is really, really good. What Wellborn and I were doing was basically taking a whole can of coconut milk, throwing that in the blender, ice. In Nicaragua, they didn't have whole pineapple, so they had some pineapple juice concentrate, and so we threw that in, and then we threw a bunch of rum in, and dude, it was so amazingly tasty. But we sat down and figured out on like day two that we probably drank about 4,000 calories a piece of like coconut milk because it was so amazingly tasty. And this is when Rob was fat, so and it did not help things at all, but it was damn tasty. So I wouldn't really recommend the coconut milk version unless you're really in a mass gain phase and don't really care about living particularly long. And the other options are pretty good. I mean, if you like wine, go for the wine. You know, red wine's pretty good to go. I had some Lambrusco, which is a Florence, or it's a wine that is typical in Tuscany. and it's a bubbly, slightly sweet red wine. It's not like a dessert wine, but it's just a little bit sweeter than say like a Pinot Noir or something like that. And it was really, really good. Like, I usually don't like wine all that much, but I really like the Lambrusco. So you could give that one a whirl, too.
Nice.
Yeah.
Never have too many alcohol questions, Rob. That's one of the guidelines of the podcast.
So. It's true. It's true. They're always very popular.
All right, Rob. Next question from Tom. We are revisiting this again because this is like literally, this probably comes in the little question queue like 5 to 10 times a week. So
it does.
Once again, Rob, what is your take on krill oil versus regular fish oil?
The krill oil is super cool. It's got some fat-associated carotenoids that are really, really good. And honestly, I haven't researched a ton of this, but it just makes me nervous harvesting the base of the food chain in the ocean, you know, basically getting out and harvesting the krill, which the krill is what feeds whales and fish and birds and, you know, all this stuff. Basically, it's kind of like the higher piece of the phytoplankton in the ocean, and it just makes me a little nervous harvesting it and using it for an oil supplement. I may be totally off base with that. I need to do a little more research with it, but it seems to be good stuff. The Eads push it and like it. They like it because of the carotenoids that are associated with krill oil. I've been doing some palm oil, like red palm oil, for exactly that purpose. Now, I'm not getting EPA and DHA out of that, but I'm getting some of those really cool fat-associated carotenoids, and I really like that stuff. So,
yep. Krill oil is not magic, though, folks, just so we're clear.
No, it's not magic. It kind of gets pushed a little bit that way that it, you know, it's orders of magnitude better than regular fish oil, and it's definitely not.
Yes. All right, next question from Mary. Hello, Rob and Andy. I know this topic has been covered several times in the podcast, but since it's something currently bothering me, I'm still asking, despite having listened to every single one of your shows. What are, in your opinion, the most important things to consider, lifestyle, diet, supplement, exercise, and otherwise, regarding excess cortisol production? I have had a saliva test, 4 samples throughout the day taken, and it revealed a wicked high cortisol and a too low DHEA. I'm a client of a clinic of restorative endocrinology in the States. I live in Finland, but luckily there's Skype, and I've got some specific instructions to take some minerals I'm lacking, magnesium, zinc, calcium, and some other stuff. I'm eating 100% paleo since January 2010, mostly based on DCFS. I sleep in pitch black and usually 8 hours. I do work out quite a lot, but I've always done that. Work as an occupational therapist is stressful but motivating and fun. Just like to hear your take on things. This cortisol issue got probably started over a year ago when I was in a bike crash. Anyway, thanks again. Hope to see you in Helsinki someday.
You know, when we look at cortisol, we can tackle this from a couple of different perspectives. You know, food. Are we getting enough? Are we getting too much? Too little? You know, undereating can be a stressor. Overeating can be a stressor. Food intolerances can be a stressor. So anything that damages or irritates the gut lining can be a serious problem. So we can kind of look at, you know, what variables of food do we have? Too much, too little, or the wrong types? You know, some sort of food intolerance kind of gig. Exercise, too much, too little. Wrong duration, you know, like Andy, you could probably comment on this after having done the OPT course, you know, where James is very wired in from kind of a Poliquin-esque perspective of find what type of critter you are and work within that. And so that's where, like, for me, doing longer duration aerobic work or longer duration Metcon type stuff absolutely crushes me. I do much better at, like, short power, you know, powerful burst type activity. And so figuring out how you're wired up for your training and then working within that in a smart and reasonable way, a little bit of periodization, some unloading, all that sort of jive. And then we've got, like, lifestyle type stuff, which includes, like, work stress, relationship stress, all that sort of jive, sleep quality. You know, are you taking care of all that stuff? Are you sleeping in a pitch black room? On and on and on. And then it sounds like a cortisol issue popped up from a bike crash. So we had some sort of, like, traumatic injury event. Was there some sort of, like, internal organ damage? Was there, like, a massive, you know, was he riding the edge? Was it, or Mary? So actually probably a she. So was Mary kind of, like, riding the edge of something here? We just had a really cool email thread with some of the folks that that I talked to via email, and with a condition called Bell's palsy, which is basically a facial paralysis that can be stimulated by a viral infection, and it's usually precipitated by a stressful event. It's a sign that the immune system is compromised. It's not totally dissimilar from shingles, and so you know, those things like shingles and Bell's palsy are symptomatic of other stuff going on, and usually it indicates that the system at large was really being challenged. It was really being stressed, and then you have one kind of precipitating event that kicks things over the edge, and this may be a little bit of what Mary had. And so probably need to do a little bit more digging. Like, you know, we have a precipitating event, a stressor. What were the other lifestyle events that were going on here, lifestyle factors? You know, how good was the food? Were you totally gluten-free? The fact that she lives in Helsinki, maybe some vitamin D deficiency. I would definitely be thinking about some potential curtailed photo period and all that sort of stuff. So looking and making sure that vitamin D is tissue levels are in the 65 to 85 nanogram per deciliter range. So those are the things that pop into my head.
Yeah, I think you handled it. The one thing that I took away, especially from OPT, additionally to his thing about figuring out what type of energy systems you play best with, was kind of his point about some of the BIOSIG stuff. Was that, you know, not that it was necessarily magic, but there were some nice correlates about, you know, additional data points like, hey, if we make changes, you know, that we think will impact your cortisol level, we should see changes, you know, in your umbilicus measurements and all that stuff. And if not, then we need to, you know, examine other solutions rather than continuing to beat our head against the wall over and over that, oh, this is the right choices that we've made. This should work.
Right, right. Totally, totally.
So, cool. Helsinki, Rob, put that on the list.
Dude, I'm game. I'm there. Paleo gets some of the biggest search terms out of Scandinavia, Finland, Denmark, Sweden, like actually a lot of activity around those areas. So
nice.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Next, got a question from Lauren. I've been following the paleo diet for quite some time and in the midst of my first pregnancy, 20 weeks currently. While I believe the paleo diet is ideal, I just wanted to know if you had any specific recommendations. Any advice would be greatly appreciated. I will be buying the book soon.
Not really anything specific other than taking a DHA-heavy fish oil supplement, staying, you know, grain, legume, dairy-free, ideally. Like, I did a blog post on paleo and pregnancy, I think, and I basically just did a breakdown looking at... it's that paper that Lauren Cordain did, which was a meal plan based on, you know, paleo diet built on contemporary foods, and looking at the amount of vitamins, minerals, antioxidants that you get calorie for calorie out of a paleo diet, and then comparing that if you were to then introduce any grains, legumes, or dairy. And what we find is that if you introduce these Neolithic foods, you immediately decrease the amount of vitamins and minerals, basically the nutrition that you were getting from the diet per calorie. So these other foods have less nutrition per calorie than what you can get out of these other, you know, paleo type foods. So it really, calorie for calorie, is the most nutritionally dense way that you can possibly eat. And I can't think of a better, you know, thing that you can do getting a little one started is just eating in a smart way that controls glycemic load and provides a load of nutrients, and then just providing all those brain cofactors so that the little buggers can grow as rapidly as they need to grow.
Yep. All right. Next question, Rob. Question from Laura. Rob and Andy, love the podcast. Thanks for doing it and answering lots of tough questions. I just finished reading Lights Out, Sleep, Sugar, Survival by T.S. Wiley and Bent Formby, and have a question about a statement they made related to barbecued meats. On page 176, it says, the average serving of barbecued or burned meat imparts to you an amount of cancer-causing particles equivalent to what you would get from smoking 250 cigarettes. I understand the burned meat part, but what do they mean by barbecued? I'm asking because I grill most of my meat, seafood for dinner, fish, steak, chicken, pork, turkey. It all tastes better on the grill. Does grilling your meats, as long as you don't burn them or cook them to death, create the same carcinogenic compounds as they state in the book? Since reading this, I've been more cognizant of not eating any part that's burned, but do I need to stop grilling too?
Oh, man. So I knew someday, this is something that I actually purposefully have not even mentioned, and it's something that actually in the whole paleo scene, probably around like 2000, 2001, when the pool of people talking about this stuff was vastly smaller, but there is some information out there floating around on some websites where some food chemists look at what some of the kind of glycation products and potential oxidative compounds that are created from different cooking techniques. And what you end up coming away from this is this understanding, and Matt Lalonde may jump in and chime in on this. He commented on, I forget if it was an email or a, must have been an email that he commented on with this, but he mentioned that he cooks all of his food at low temperature, usually in water, you know, kind of like a slow cooker type thing. Because when you look at trying to minimize reactive oxygen species and any type of nitrosamine formation or some of these nastier food products that are brought about by cooking, what you're left with is like steaming and boiling if you don't want to create any of these problematic compounds. You know, anytime you get browning, you have some problematic molecules on the food from like a toxicological standpoint. So yeah, grilling ends up being somewhat of a problem. But then the reason why I've never brought this stuff up is that we're just trying to get some general buy-in from people and not totally freak them the hell out. And so if we really start talking about this other side of things with the cooking techniques, you know, I usually tell people as an aside, cook on low to medium heat. Don't scorch your food. And and we just say don't, you know, oxidize your fatty acids in your food and stuff like that. And really what that is, it's just trying to not create more of a thing about all this. But now there's actually been a number of questions, like this topic has just been waiting to kind of pop up. And so here it is. So we'll just kind of have to take it head on. Grilling your food creates more problematic compounds, including polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which can get in and like intercalate or slice through DNA, and they are bad. And this is basically like the kind of charcoaling type stuff that you see on grilled meat or veggies. You get nitrosamines, which are these protein derivative compounds, which are really pretty nasty from a toxicological standpoint. The higher the temperature of cooking, the more potential for browning, then the more likely you are to produce a number of these compounds. There's a bunch of other compounds that I'm totally blanking on right now, but if you want to minimize the production of this stuff, then baking things covered, braising, like cooking stuff in water, boiling, steaming, that sort of stuff, low temperature cooking like in a crock pot or something. If it's higher temperature cooking, like in a pressure cooker, but even then, pressure cooker temperatures are lower than any type of like grilling or frying and stuff like that. So when it's all said and done, I honestly don't know how huge of a deal this is. If it's just a huge deal breaker for you one way or another, it's like you really, really like grilling, just try to grill smart. Some of these infrared grills are kind of cool because it distributes the heat a little bit. You're a little less likely of getting a flare up or a fire up, and so a little less likely to get some scorch on your food. I guess that's some stuff to consider, but in general, I don't want to freak people out about this too much because they'll just be like, oh my God, I can't grill, and oh my God, I can't fry anything, and so then they just go back to eating bagels. Like it's really like this crazy slippery slope with this, and so it's a topic that I've been cringing, waiting for it to pop up for like 3 or 4 years, and it seems to have happened. So there you are.
You said it first, Rob. Grilling is better than eating bagels.
It's possibly better than eating bagels, but not better than eating five fries.
Well, nothing is better than five fries.
Indeed. Except maybe six fries. So,
did you see the picture of Matt LaLonde eating the 5 pounds of lamb or whatever on Facebook?
No, I didn't.
You need to go. He was visiting someone. Someone commented, you know, Barry Sears would be horrified because he may overeat. It's possible.
Awesome.
All right, next we got a question from Eric. Any paleo solutions for seasonal allergies? Looking for relief from pollen allergies without medication.
You know, the standard paleo diet, grain-free, dairy-free, all that stuff, like if we lower systemic inflammation, then we tend to see much improved allergies. It doesn't always fix everything. Two kind of nutraceutical-based things that you could try to do. Activated quercetin can be a pretty nice, it's you can't quite call it a full-on histamine blocker, but it has some interesting modulating effects on histamine production. Source Naturals is a really good company for getting activated quercetin. And then this is kind of a wacky one, but getting bee pollen from your local area, you actually can get a little bit of a desensitization process by eating a little bit of bee pollen that is produced locally. But if you need to make sure that it's locally produced, because it needs to be coming from the plants and whatnot that are locally derived. And I haven't seen much study that would support this. Like, I've fished around for it, but there's a lot of anecdotal stuff floating around out there that the locally derived bee pollen might be helpful for some of that stuff. So, I mean, get your basic paleo ducks in a row, make sure you're sleeping, dark room, all that sort of jive, make sure your training is smart. I mean, again, I just can't emphasize enough, all that stuff is absolutely critical, because all of it is really the major players with regards to how much inflammation you're going to be experiencing. If you decrease inflammation, you're going to decrease the relative severity of your allergies. And then from there, you've got some of these kind of naturopathic, nutraceutical type approaches that you could do.
Cool. Good question. Unfortunately, paleo is not magic. People still have allergies.
It doesn't cure cancer.
I wish it only
Chuck Norris's tears.
Chuck Norris's tears. Maybe we can get a line of Rob Wolf t-shirts with sayings like that. Ooh, that would be funny.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Question from Catherine. Hi, Rob. I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I've been on an insulin pump for about 3 years. I am now 5 months pregnant with my first baby, and my endocrinologist cannot figure me out. He told me at the beginning of my pregnancy that my insulin usage would steadily increase as my pregnancy progressed. He also said if I had any morning sickness, it could be very dangerous and cause some lows. When I got pregnant, I was on a basal rate of 0.55 units per hour, and my A1C was 7.5. I go to the endocrinologist every other week to get an A1C done, and this week it was the lowest I can ever remember at 5.7. What shocked my doctor was that I told him my basal rate was down to 0.25 units per hour. Also, my carb ratio started at 1 unit per 10 carbs, and now I'm at either 12 or 13, depending on the time of day. Apparently, this is completely contrary to what normally happens to type 1 diabetics during pregnancy. I never did get any of that nausea or sickness either. That is also typical during pregnancy. Any thoughts on insulin use and why it dropped?
Holy cats. You know, I have no idea on this. Like, this is a really interesting piece. We could do some more digging around later. Like, I dug around on this a fair amount and didn't really come up with anything. It is totally counterintuitive, because normally we see a impaired insulin sensitivity during pregnancy, because we're shuttling more. We need to create basically an insulin resistance in the mother so that we have a nutrient flow that goes to the fetus. If the mother is too nutrient sensitive, too insulin sensitive, then we're not really going to get that flow towards the fetus. And so normally during any type of pregnancy, we see, whether type 1 or otherwise, we usually see a little bit of insulin resistance in the mother. And I've written about like gestational diabetes and why that comes about. Like, most people are usually eating poorly enough that they're already kind of borderline diabetic, and then the increased insulin resistance that comes about from a pregnancy ends up pushing them into full-on gestational diabetes. And then there's some other, you know, weird situations when people are eating low carb that they can look like they're gestationally diabetic, but they're not. This situation is really odd, because like the insulin use has gone down, all that stuff. The only thing that I could think of is maybe you're sleeping a little better. Some women do. Sometimes they sleep a little bit better. Potentially also, like, you're just being a little more fastidious with your food. And then this is the outsidest one but it may actually be the thing that's going on. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune reaction. And so, you know, typically it precipitates from an autoimmune scenario. And it could be interesting in that you are actually one of those people that maybe still has some pancreatic function left. And I don't know if you have ever gone 100% grain, legume, dairy free, but you might actually have, when women become pregnant, they get an immunosuppressant effect because the fetus could potentially experience a tissue rejection, similar to like a transplanted organ or something like that. So the it's very, very common that women who are suffering from autoimmune diseases see a remarkable improvement in their autoimmune disease while pregnant. So this could be what's going on, that actually some of the pancreatic inflammation, pancreatic damage that's been occurring as a type 1 diabetic, you may still actually have some functioning pancreatic tissue in your body. And when I think about all this stuff, that's probably the most likely thing that's going on with this. I haven't seen examples of that specifically in the literature in a type 1 diabetic or in a type 1 diabetic pregnancy situation, but I've seen the reversal of type 1 diabetic symptoms in other scenarios in the literature, and usually with the improvement of gut health and reduction of inflammation. So that's my thought on that. We're actually seeing a resolution in the type 1 diabetes symptomology and inflammation in the pancreas, and you're actually probably getting some endogenous insulin production.
Yep. That is a very unusual situation.
And there's probably some testing, if I thought about how you could go about doing that. Like, they could do some radio-labeled insulin in your pump, and then you could see where that is going in the body, do some tissue biopsy. And if you are seeing tissue that isn't expressing radio-labeled insulin, then you probably have some inhibition of the endogenous insulin. I'd have to think about that some more, how you could do a study design to figure out if it's your own insulin that's being produced with that. But there's probably some fairly easy ways that you could do it. But again, one thing that I would think about this, have you ever gone 100% grain, legume, dairy free? Because if you haven't, and if you are experiencing, like, if you do potentially still have pancreatic function, you might be able to improve this whole scenario even when you're not pregnant. Like, you may be able to reverse the type 1 diabetes or dramatically improve it.
Yep. Cool.
So tinker with that and let me know what you do. I'd be really interested to know the follow-up on that.
All right. Next, we got a question from Big Chris. Hey, Rob. Thanks for the podcast. I listen to them every week, and I cannot wait to read the book. A little background info. 32, 6 foot, 300 pounds, and just started eating paleo. Been an athlete all my life in numerous sports and currently training, competing in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu during college football, semi-pro, rugby, powerlifting. I have juiced in the past, but it has been a few years. After a back injury, I gained at least 50 pounds and had no energy. I was diagnosed with secondary hypogonadism and given a testosterone script. Definitely felt better when I was on the test. Wanted to work out more. Knowing that I want to have kids one day, I no longer take the testosterone. My lowest blood test score was in the 150s about a year ago. And now after my script, it is totally out of my system. I'm in the 250s, just below my doc says. So there's been some improvement when I train jits and lift. Here's the question. Do I go back on the test to help me lose the weight and then try recovering again? Or do I suffer through and try to drop the gut naturally? My hip measurement is 46 and waist is 52. Ergo, most of my fat is in the abdominal area. I know I must seem like a complete fat ass, but I assure you I can squat dead 400 anytime I want, do back round offs, do over 10 kipping pull-ups. I win most nagas and grappler quests I compete in. The weight loss is truly difficult now, unlike when I was a wrestler back in the day, and I don't know what to do. Doctors have given me opinions to either. If I do cardio in the morning, I have no energy to lift. If I lift, I don't want to go to practice. I still have a decent amount of muscle. It seems that energy loss is my biggest issue. Mornings are best due to higher levels of natural testosterone, I assume. Sorry about the length of this question. Thanks, man. Any help would be appreciated.
Wowzers. Interesting stuff. Like, this would be a lot easier to figure out what's going on with like a really comprehensive metabolic and endocrine panel. I would really want to know what free versus bound testosterone is, what cortisol is, and for the cortisol, I'd want to know like a 24-hour cortisol, like an ASI test type deal. Definitely figuring out some of the insulin growth hormone axis stuff. There's probably something else going on here. Like, if the cortisol is really high, some other things, like, I would want to know a little bit more information. Tracking down a good naturopath, tracking down a functional medicine doc, possibly a biosignature practitioner might be able to help with some of this stuff. But there's a little bit more under the hood stuff that I would want to know to be able to direct you in the right direction. A good functional medicine doc would be a really, really good asset. And with all these people, I would always preface, like, when you're interviewing them, say, what do you think about the paleo diet? And if they, one, haven't heard about it, or two, think it's bunk, then I would go shopping elsewhere as a starter. Obviously, there's some testosterone production issues. You start thinking about sleep. You start thinking about, like, some other factors that are going on. If insulin is real high, then you can start getting some competitive inhibition of inhibition of testosterone production via increased cortisol release. Like, there's a lot of moving parts here that we need a little bit more information on to figure out more of what's going on. But I would definitely do some investigating to figure that stuff out, because you'll lean out faster, you'll feel way better. It may come down to needing to do some exogenous testosterone therapy to really get down lean and get healthy and whatnot. But with some other tweaking, you may be able to rely on some stuff like a really high quality tribulus, maybe some DHEA supplementation in conjunction with that, and you might be able to pop up endogenous testosterone production without suppressing spermatogenesis, which is part of the problem with the testosterone supplementation. Like, you end up shutting down sperm production. So there's some other ways around this, but I would need a little more information. You would need some more comprehensive blood work to get in and see the full picture, but I would definitely investigate that stuff.
Yep, good question though.
Yeah.
And Rob, with that's it, man. The end of episode 51.
Dude, can it be?
We're almost to 1 year, 52 full episodes.
What are we going to do to celebrate?
I don't know.
Catnip all around. Catnip for Gatto.
Yeah, we'll have to give Keystone something. He's really the linchpin that holds this thing together. So I'll have to give it some thought.
Totally. we'll roll Keystone a giant catnip reefer and, you know, just get him, watch him get crazy. So. He's passed out, draped across my leg right now, and his ears are twitching, so it's pretty funny. He knows he's being talked about.
His ears are burning.
Yeah, totally.
All right, man. Well, thanks for your time. We'll talk to you again next week on the Mythical Episode 52.
Awesome, man. Thanks, Andy.
All right, see you, Rob.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.